Ladies and gentlemen, here's our regular weekday morning roundup of the latest news, for which we turn to our staff correspondents at home and abroad. Now we switch first to John McVane, reporting from the BBC studios in London.
This is London. Hundreds of British bombers last night made heavy attacks on Mannheim in southwestern Germany. They dropped hundreds of tons of bombs. Saint Nazaire on the French coast was heavily bombed. Mines were laid in enemy waters, and the British attacked aerodromes in France and Holland. 12 bombers and 2 fighters are missing. German raiders made a short attack on a town in the northeast of England. This morning I had an experience that's an ordinary one for people living here. Before the war, I used to have a Fleet Street newspaper man friend named Jack Oaten. I left England before war began. When I came back, Jack and his wife had disappeared and we couldn't find any trace of them. People thought Jack was in one of the forces. This morning I found out about Jack. His face is in most of the London papers. He piloted one of the Beauforts that sent torpedoes into the Prince Eugen on Sunday. 9 British planes were lost, but Jack came back. Direct information from the Russian front reaching official circles in London doesn't give any comprehensive picture of the situation, but it may help you interpret the daily reports from Russia and Germany if I tell you how the best informed quarters here see the Kerch and Kharkov fighting. In the first place, it's pointed out, the German attack on the Kerch Peninsula is a German attempt to guard their flank. It's the necessary preliminary before a general offensive could be safely begun. Unless that peninsula were cleared, the Russians would always be in a position to drive suddenly against the German rear. Secondly, the Russian attack at Kharkov isn't yet a real big offensive, but it may have big results in checking the German spring drive. It wasn't tied up with the Kerch attack. While the Germans were piling up material and placing their divisions for their big do-or-die offensive, Timoshenko suddenly seized the initiative and attacked in the front of something over 100 miles. Driving this pocket into the German line, he has in all probability upset the careful plans of the German high command. They must have had to yank divisions from farther north and from their reserves to hold and try to reduce the Russian pocket. This forced shift of carefully placed and poised forces will, it's thought, have an effect on German plans for a much larger area than the actual fighting front. If Timoshenko's men continue to drive forward successfully, it's believed that the Russian commander is ready to throw in the men and material to make it a really large-scale offensive. If they don't, he'll keep his main strength in reserve. If the Russians have captured important armaments and fuel dumps that the Germans were getting ready for their offensive, they've scored a real success. Timoshenko might be said to be in the position of a boxer who sees his burly opponent drawing back for a knockout blow and throws him off balance with a snappy straight left. In usually well-informed quarters, I've recently found a growing feeling that if the United Nations can start an offensive in the West, or even a large-scale diversion, Germany can be beaten this year. This has been the Russian theme for some time. Now people who a few months or even a few weeks ago would have dismissed the idea as impossible are beginning to talk of it as one of those things that just might be pulled off. These people aren't among the few in this country who have any exact knowledge of the United Nations plans for the immediate future. They don't know what ships and material can be used, but they do know it would take daring thinking and planning and brilliant execution. It's well known here that the thing the German high command dreads most is an attack in the West, because such an attack might crack into the interior morale of the German civilians who for months have had to endure the morale-destroying knowledge that thousands of German men are being killed every day. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
In Moscow, where it's now after 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Robert Magadoff is ready to report. So we turn to Mr. Magadoff in the Soviet capital. Go ahead, Moscow.
This is Robert Magadoff speaking from Moscow. The German General von Bock is trying to cripple Timoshenko's offensive in the Kharkov area by striking at the left flank of his armies. No details of von Bock's push have as yet been released, and the latest Russian communique even failed to mention it. Whatever measure of success, if any, von Bock may have achieved in his drive toward Izhin and Barvenkovo to the southeast and south of Kharkov, it has not, up to now, set Timoshenko's sweep toward and around Kharkov. The reports which keep pouring in from various sectors of the front say that the marshal is moving with relentless speed. His main armies are already operating deep in the German defense line, while specially assigned tank, cavalry, and aviation units are pursuing the fleeing enemy. The aim, as you can easily guess, is not to allow them time for regrouping into powerful, organized islands of resistance to the rear and on the flanks of Timoshenko's advancing main forces. The Russians have devised an apparently effective method of combating the superior number of enemy tanks. A counterattack by Hitler's Panzer was first met by a deadly barrage from field guns, anti-tank guns, and anti-tank rifles. After considerable damage is done, Soviet tanks, which they claimed were as qualitatively superior, go into action, completing the breakdown of the counterattack. In one sector alone, 122 German tanks were wrecked by just such tactics. Russian confidence remains firm. It has found its most eloquent expression in the feverish work of reconstruction in the villages recaptured from the enemy but yesterday and the day before. The guns are still rolling nearby, and the rattle of machine guns is still annoying the ear. But collective farmers have already launched their spring sowing. The women and children are busy among vegetable patches, and damaged houses are being repaired. Goodbye from Moscow.
Now, reports from the Pacific Theater of War, reports which come to us through the newsroom in San Francisco.
Now, across the Pacific to United Nations headquarters in Australia. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Martin Agronsky somewhere in Australia. The all quiet is today's report for the Southwest Pacific. Up north, the closest possible watch is being kept on all Jap movements to the northwest and northeast of this continent within range of our aerial reconnaissance. Naturally, any hour could bring the naval contact, which would signal the opening of the second phase of the Battle of the Southwest Pacific. Under MacArthur, our forces in the forward combat area are geared to go into a coordinated air and naval attack or defense the minute that phase begins. It is fruitless to speculate whether the first action of the coming battle will be as a result of our initiative or that of the Japs. Our fleet went up north to hit the Japs and the Solomons 3 weeks ago, immediately before the enemy began moving south. It will do the Japs good to keep guessing as to whether our fleet intends to hit them first again, or if we intend to let them start south till they arrive at the point where it suits us best to offer battle. The immediate job of MacArthur's command is to keep hitting from the air any Jap concentration that looks like growing too large for comfort. Never in any theater of war has so much depended on air power. At the moment, the air is the only medium through which we are in contact with the enemy. Except for anti-aircraft crews, there's not a single doughboy in the American Expeditionary Forces here today who has fired a single hostile shot at the Japs. The enemy is real only to the airmen. A bombing target to be hit daily, hundreds of miles away from the most forward of the Allied bases. The realization that this is an air war first, a naval war second, and a land war only if our air and naval power is destroyed, is what must be understood. The daily record of activities issued at headquarters here proves that even with what may be inferior numbers in the air, we are able to hurt the Jap more than he hurts us. To observers here, it seems a simple enough step in an analytical process of reasoning to make the next deduction from the established fact of our quality superiority. That is, that if a real effort is made to provide our forces here with large numbers of aircraft, Australia can become an offensive base rather than the defensive and dangerously threatened holding base that it is, in fact, today. Looking from Australia, it still seems to observers here that London, at least, still seems to have difficulty in grasping the real position here. The statement of Britain's Deputy Prime Minister Attlee in the House of Commons yesterday, in which he pledged British reinforcements to Australia, has come in for very careful examination here. Mr. Attlee said it was, I quote, unsound to concentrate major forces in any one area before Japan revealed her main objective, unquote. Leaving aside the fact that Mr. Attlee's statement reveals a defensive attitude in strange contrast with a much publicized comment on Australia as an offensive base, Britain's Deputy Prime Minister seems to have forgotten Hong Kong, Malaya, the Dutch East Indies, the Philippines, and Burma, By the time the Japs had revealed their main objectives on those battlefields, Britain and the United States found it was much too late to do anything about sending reinforcements. From this side of the world, the Allied grand strategy still looks obscure. The one thing responsible authorities here are agreed upon is that the Japs have so far thrived on the Allied inability to make their bases strong while the opportunity still offered. This is Martin Agronsky returning you now to San Francisco.
From the newsroom in San Francisco, we take you across the continent to Earl Godwin in the newsroom in New York.
And from the newsroom here in New York, we're going to switch you now to our correspondent in the nation's capital, Earl Godwin, in Washington.
It's all right. You know, that's Jimmy Doolittle's idea. He held a press conference late yesterday afternoon. I guess the news is all out on him by now, but one thing he did, which proves him a gallant gentleman and a champion thoroughbred, was that he telephoned to the families of the 79 men who accompanied him on his amazing flight from Shangri-La to Tokyo and back to Shangri-La. You know, that was the action of a gentleman. He got the Congressional Medal of Honor. The 79 with him get Distinguished Service Crosses. And do you notice in this war, the heroes are getting the awards now, not waiting to die for flowers. Here's something you may like to know. The Japs have been the greatest plan and map makers. They planned and mapped their own country down to the last building. And one of the advantages we have is that our army has most of those plans and the maps of buildings and cities. I don't know whether Doolittle's dynamite dunkers had any of these Jap maps with them, but they appeared to know just what to do and where to lay those eggs when they got there. Our newly formed Board of Economic Warfare here has a barn full of information on Japanese factories and industries and roads and railroads and dams. They know where the railroad lines are. They know where the bottlenecks are. They know just where to blow up a bridge to stop the very traffic the Japs depend on. So don't get the idea that all the advantage is on the Japanese side when it comes to maps, for distinctly it is not. The fastest ship production the world has ever seen is now the record of the U.S. Maritime Commission, with its 120 ships in 130 days. And 30 ships, mind you, count them if you want, 30, will be launched from American shipyards on the day after tomorrow, which is Maritime Day in America. And there will be great doings all over the country, particularly at shipyards, and radio messages around the world from shipyards and shipworkers here to shipyards and shipworkers there and back again. This morning seems to show a preponderance of heavy rationers in your government at Washington. The president, I thought as I attended his press conference and radio conference yesterday, believes along the lines of Sam Rayburn, the Speaker of the House, who says that rationing gas in areas where it is plentiful, and so plentiful it cannot be stored, is just plain nonsense. I quote Mr. Rayburn. But the War Production Board is jittery over rubber and tires, wants to enforce tire conservation by drastic cuts in the opportunity to use tires, and so nationwide gas rationing is the threat at this hour, or the possibility, I might say. But Mr. Rayburn says anyone knows that tires are scarce. Anyone knows that he will not have any more tires during the war. Anyone knows that if you keep your speed down to less than 30 miles an hour, your tires will last, you might say, indefinitely. So I say that gas rationing where gas is superabundant is just plain nonsense. I was quoting Mr. Rayburn, and I think possibly he will have supporters in that view, and that's all from Washington at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Godwin. These have been reports by John McVain from London, Robert Magadoff from Moscow, Martin Nagransky speaking from Australia, and Earl Godwin in our nation's capital. Now for the latest news, we suggest that you keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.